Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. 5 million people have tested positive for the COVID-19 virus. 162,000 have died in the U.S. since February. In Pennsylvania, 121,000 have contracted the virus and 7,200 have died. Almost 6 months into this pandemic, the nation has seen an increase in cases over the past month or so, but there are fewer hospitalizations and deaths on a daily basis. We heard a lot about a second wave of the coronavirus, but most experts say we're not even through the first wave yet. Much has changed over the last 6 months, including what we know about COVID-19 and don't know. Joining us today is Dr. John Goldman, infectious disease specialist at UPMC Pinnacle. Dr. Goldman, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
This is your opportunity to ask questions about COVID-19, the coronavirus. You know, we've tried to do this every few weeks since the pandemic began, and it still has to, I have to say, it still surprises me the number of questions that are unanswered for many people. If you have one of those questions, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Goldman, I was looking back through our records, and I saw that the last time you were on the show was in May. Now, I'm not going to ask you what we've learned just since May, but what have we learned, what have you learned about COVID-19 over the last 6 months?
I think over the last 6 months, we've learned a lot about treating COVID-19, and we've learned a lot about preventing COVID-19. So in terms of treatment, there are now at least two evidence-based medicine approaches. One is pretty simple. One is giving a drug called dexamethasone. It's a steroid. It decreases the immune response, probably in severe COVID-19 disease. Part of the morbidity, part of what hurts people, is an overreaction of the immune system. And simply giving a steroid, a drug, dexamethasone, you give it for 10 days, in patients who are sick enough to be in the hospital and require oxygen, it decreases mortality 20-25%. Patients who are very sick and end up in the intensive care unit, it decreases mortality by 30%. 20% fewer people die, 30% fewer people die. We often combine that with a drug called remdesivir. Remdesivir is a drug that works directly to inhibit the virus. It's been shown mainly to decrease time to recovery in clinical trials when they compare it to placebo. It has not been shown to affect mortality. But we very frequently give dexamethasone, and we very frequently give remdesivir together. My clinical experience, which is kind of a code word for this is what I think happens, I'm not sure I can back it up with true literature, seems to be that we get much better outcomes. We also have learned a lot about preventing it. If you look at Pennsylvania, before we started social distancing, before we started wearing masks, the average person who was infected with COVID infected 2.5 to 3 people. With social distancing, with wearing masks, we actually, during the height of the lockdown, got that down to less than one person. We got that down to the point where the disease was going away. When the lockdown was eased, it went up to about 1.2, so that's why we saw an increase in cases. And now it's just about 1 to 1, so every person with COVID on average only infects one other person. That means the disease has not gotten particularly, is not going up quickly and not going down quickly. So we've learned a lot about, we take better care of people. We've seen a decrease, I think we've seen a decrease in the number of patients who get severe disease. We've seen a decrease in the number of patients who die. And I think we've learned a lot about what we need to do to prevent the disease.
So I want to go back to what you were talking about originally. This steroid that you're talking about, is it one, you mentioned the name, but is it one steroid in particular, or is this just like a simple steroid that people are given for other reasons?
So we always use a drug called dexamethasone. It's a specific type of steroid, and the reason that we always use that drug is it's been shown to work. So in trials where they gave dexamethasone or they gave a placebo or they gave a sugar pill, the mortality went down. So we always specifically give that steroid, and it's as simple as it's been shown to work. We don't know if we give it. We think if we give another steroid, it will probably work. We don't know that for sure, but it's a simple steroid. It's not an expensive drug. It's not an antiviral. It doesn't inhibit the virus. And one of the important things about it, as time goes on, in other coronaviruses, in the SARS virus that occurred about 10 years ago, giving steroids actually increased, not decreased, mortality. So this is a good, and in fact, when this epidemic first started, this pandemic first started, there were a lot of groups that recommended against steroid usage. I didn't use it until I saw that it worked. So this is a good example of, as the pandemic went on, as we apply good, rigorous science to how you treat this drug, how you treat this disease, we learn how to take care of it better. And in fact, we really are seeing fewer patients end up getting really sick, and we are really seeing fewer patients die.
I think you just answered my question, but is that what you attribute fewer hospitalizations and deaths to on a daily basis now?
So I attribute it to a whole slew of factors. The first and probably most important is currently we are seeing more young people get the disease. And a 20-year-old who gets the disease has a 0.1, 0.2, 1 out of 1,000, 2 out of 1,000 chance of dying. An 80-year-old gets the disease, has a 15%, 15 out of 100, 150 out of 1,000. They're just simply at much lower risk. So we're currently in a portion of the pandemic where we're seeing more young people get infected. They simply have a less chance of dying. Secondly, we have learned a lot about protecting vulnerable populations, keeping the disease out of nursing homes. And I think at least part of why the mortality was higher initially was the virus got into nursing homes, it spread easily within nursing homes, and it infected the most vulnerable people, the people with the highest mortality. I also think that aside from remdesivir, we're just better at taking, when people do get sick, we're better at taking care of them, ranging from these drugs to, we now know that it probably, you should try to avoid intubating them, putting on a ventilator, and you should probably give them some form of anticoagulation, some form of blood thinner, because for reasons we don't totally understand, COVID infection is associated with higher levels of clotting. But it's really a combination of, right now we're getting young people, we're protecting vulnerable populations, and we're better at taking care of people with the disease.
So there may be some people who would hear that and say, well, we can open up now. We can ease some of the restrictions we have. Would you agree with that?
I would disagree with that, and it's pretty simple. When we have enough protective equipment, when we have enough drug, when we have enough intensive care unit beds, we take really good care of people. When you overwhelm the system, like they did in New York, like they did in New Jersey, and in fact like they're doing in Texas and Florida, we don't take as good care of people. We are likely to have enough dexamethasone. There's a very small amount of remdesivir available. We always have to very carefully monitor our stock, and we have to make sure that it is used appropriately. If we saw a big surge of patients, we wouldn't have enough of the drug. If we see really big surges of patients, we might not have enough intensive care unit beds, and we might not have enough ventilators. Now, we hope to avoid that at all costs, but the current social distancing allows there to be fewer cases, which means that there are fewer patients ending up in the hospital, the systems don't get overwhelmed, and we can take really good care of people. If the system gets overwhelmed, we don't do that job as well.
I want to start asking some questions from listeners, Dr. Goldman. Rick in Harrisburg, what is known about myocarditis resulting from COVID-19 infections? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Absolutely. So myocarditis is an inflammation of the heart, and it's known that it occurs. It's not totally clear how common it is, and it's not totally clear how serious it is. Remember, this disease appeared on this earth in December of this year. We've known about it 6-7 months. We've known about the flu for 200 years. We've studied the flu for 200 years. So what we do know is that COVID very frequently affects the heart. We know that in patients with severe disease, we often see inflammation of the heart. We often see blood work and so forth that affects that. And one of the concerns, for example, with student athletes returning is people with asymptomatic disease, people who don't have a lot of other symptoms, can still get myocarditis. And there's a concern that if an athlete gets myocarditis, they might be at higher mortality. They might be at a higher risk of something bad happening, of it infecting their heart, or of their even dying. One of the things that is known is that one of the presentations of COVID is young people who have had asymptomatic disease and show up in the hospital with a stroke. So one of the problems is we're just learning a lot about this disease. It clearly affects the heart, but we don't quite know how often, we don't quite know how to prevent it, and we don't quite know how to treat it, and we don't quite know how serious it is. So we know it occurs, but we don't know as much as we would like yet.
You know, there have been so many people, and you just touched about on studying the flu, influenza, for 200 years. But there are still people that you hear say this is no more serious than the flu. Becca in Lebanon asks, if it is more dangerous than the flu, how do I explain to people who still don't believe that it's real or dangerous?
So there are a few different ways. The first is just simply the statistics. So in this country, for documented cases, the current mortality for COVID is about 3%. That would mean that it is 30 times more lethal than the flu. Now, one of the things that's argued and I believe in is that there are probably 10 times as many cases as documented cases. So that mortality is probably lower than 3%. The general consensus is it's around 0.5%. Now, 0.5%, 1 out of 200 people, sounds on the surface as being, well, that's pretty low. If I get it, I only have a 1 out of 200 chance of dying. On the other hand, with the flu, it's 0.1, 1 out of 1,000. And if you think what would happen if the disease just simply went unchecked through the population, so we just let the disease go through, we just simply tried to get to herd immunity, we tried to get as many people infected, we'd have to have about 300 million people infected.
Wow.
That would mean about 1.5 million would die. In the worst flu season, we have 50,000 die. If this disease, even if the mortality is only 0.5%, were to simply go through the population, that would mean about 1.5 million Americans die. That's just simply orders of magnitude worse than the flu.
That's, you know, to quote some more statistics, that 162,000 people who have died in the U.S. in February, that's just in the U.S. It's a 500,000 around the world, but 162,000 people have died in the U.S. That is just since February.
Yep.
So it's a whole lot more than the normal influenza or flu that we would normally see in a season.
So, yeah, and that's probably an underestimation. The way they actually calculate flu deaths is you look at excess deaths in the population. You know what, how many people during any given season normally die, and they calculate flu deaths by saying how much excess deaths, how many more people die than we expected. And when you do that same calculation with people with areas that have been infected with COVID, there's a large amount of excess deaths, and that's despite the fact that people are often at home. Deaths from things like car accidents go down. And so we have 160,000 or so deaths. The true death rate is probably much higher.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things considered, and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Join Rebecca Carroll for Come Through, featuring conversations about race. She talks with great thinkers, writers, and artists about faith, representation, and how it's all playing out in 2020. Listen to Come Through Fridays at 9 on WITF, that is tomorrow morning. We're answering your questions today about the coronavirus, COVID-19. Our guest is Dr. John Goldman, infectious disease specialist at UPMC Pinnacle. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Goldman, we have a question from Todd, who asks, for public speaking events, like in schools and churches, is it effective to have a plexiglass screen in front of the speaker to limit the transmission of COVID particles to the audience? This is, of course, assuming the audience are all wearing masks in return.
That is effective, but I think the most effective thing is simply wearing a mask. So when you look at things like partitions, they clearly work. But the most important thing is masking truly works. When you've seen countries that have had widespread public masking, they are doing a much better job at keeping the virus under control keeping the virus under control than we are. And in fact, they're natural experiments. So for example, there was a pair of hairdressers in a woman's salon that both had COVID. They were masked, their customers were masked, and they cut the hair of something like 100, 200 women, and there was not a single case of transmission. And so clearly masks work. From our own experience, one of the ways we've made UPMC Pinnacle very safe, we have not had really any transmission from provider to provider or patient to provider or provider to patient, and that's by simply having people wear masks while they're at work, while they're in the hospital. And as soon as we started doing that, we basically stopped seeing people who were infected outside of the hospital infect their coworkers at work. As a result, we've been able to, with mask wearing, we've been able to keep the hospital extremely safe.
Dr. Goldman, what you just said about the effectiveness of masks, for whatever reason, whether it's political, whatever, we have a segment of the population that refuses to wear a mask. Part of it is they say their freedom is being, that they're free to do what they want, or that they don't believe that the coronavirus is as bad as what they've been saying. So will we ever get to a point where we can defeat this if you're going to have a large segment of the population? And I'm not saying this is the only way to get rid of it, but that large segment of the population that refuses to wear a mask?
I personally do not. And I personally think that there's a lot of concern about getting us back to normal, getting small businesses open, getting restaurants open. And if people are not willing to wear masks, we're going to see what we're seeing now, which is continued spread of the virus at a low level. We're not seeing it exponentially spread, but through the population. That will prevent us from getting kids back to school. That will prevent us from opening up small businesses, and that'll hurt the economy. I think if people are not willing to mask, there will be continued transmission, and what will end the pandemic. We'll either be getting an effective vaccine, which is probably at earliest in early 2021, or getting herd immunity. When the virus just simply has gone through enough of the population that it can't easily spread itself anymore. And that is probably also 18 to 24 months away. So people kind of have a choice. They can either put up with this, meaning expect to keep having the virus with us in our quote-unquote new normal for the next year, year and a half, or we can wear masks, try to get it down, and get something back, get back to a much more normal life.
You mentioned kids going back to school. Do you think that it can be done safely?
I think that it can be done safely, but it takes buy-in for things like wearing masks. And one of the issues with this pandemic is you're often balancing bad options. So I have had two kids at home doing virtual college. I personally don't think, even for college students, virtual learning is as good as in-person learning. And I think my personal opinion is that it's better to have, from an academic perspective, it's better to have kids back in school. On the other hand, this is an easy way to spread the virus. The kids are close together. Young kids especially, it's very difficult to have them wear masks. And we will have to put a lot of thought into, for older kids, my personal opinion is masks should be required. I think we have to screen teachers and students, and I think we have to get people out of the habit of, if someone is just a kid is just a little sick, you send them to school. The good news is the children themselves don't get badly sick very often. There's some countries where no one under the age of 50 has died of COVID. On the other hand, there are rare complications. There have been some children who have died. There is this diffuse inflammatory syndrome, which presents like a common childhood illness called Kawasaki's disease. It can cause kids to get very sick. It can cause kids to die. But it also is fortunately very rare. The bigger issue is the kids who often have minimal symptoms will come home and infect their parents, who both may get sick and may spread it, or worse, infect elderly grandparents who are often caregivers, who are often caring for the kids while their parents are at work. And those people are at a much higher mortality. What you really worry about is that it's going to drive the epidemic, that we'll see higher numbers in the fall. And I think we have to put a lot of thought. I think it's something that's worthwhile to do. I think we have to put a lot of thought in how we do it safely. I personally think every teacher should be masked. Every adult who works in the building should be masked. And we should mask any kid that can tolerate it.
You know, that last part that where you were talking about kids bringing it home, that seems to be part of the conversation that is often missed in this discussion about returning students to school. I mean, for those who are just hell-bent on kids going back to school in the classroom, they cite statistics that you talked about earlier about very few deaths, that children, for the most part, young people, don't get as sick. Those are the statistics that they cite more often. But the first thought that came to my mind is that just because they're not as sick doesn't mean they're not going to take the virus home and expose older people or those who may have some pre-existing condition to the disease, right?
Exactly. So one of the things that I would advise a parent who is going to send their kid back to school is they have to put some thought into it. So, for example, if the kid after school is taken care of by a 70, 80-year-old grandparent, that's high risk, because the 70, 80-year-old grandparent probably has between a 5 and a 15% mortality. These are the people who make up most of the deaths with COVID. And so you really have to think about, if the kids are at school or at higher risk, should you be seeing older or sicker grandparents? My advice would be probably not. Or if the grandkids are seeing older, sicker grandparents, Everybody probably has to be masked when they do that. So there is, the kids are less likely to get sick, but there is real potential to spread to other people. And in fact, there's a statistic out there that something like 40% of people who have had COVID have gotten it at home, usually a parent or grandparent who gets it from a kid who is out working. And especially people who are living in intergenerational households, the parents and the grandparents are both there, you really have to think about how to prevent the kids from getting the grandparents, the parents or even the grandparents sick.
Another question from a listener. Temperature taking is a big part of mitigation and screening for COVID. Schools and organizations are using it to determine access, etc. But no one in the medical community that I have heard of, now this is from, a question from outside the building, has said that an elevated body temp is a first symptom or a warning flare that someone is infected. How often is it that someone has an elevated temperature and feels perfectly fine? Aren't you starting to feel symptomatic by that point?
You know what? That's a great question, because they're absolutely right. There are a lot of asymptomatic people with COVID. And there are a lot of people who will not have a temperature. One of the things that we've done at UPMC Pinnacle is I get screened and have my temperature taken every day when I come into work. And the way I would describe this is it's kind of part of what we call an infection control, a bundle. We do a whole bunch of different things to try to prevent disease. And when all is said and done, we know that the bundle, all these different things that we did, worked. But we don't know which of what we're doing is most effective. It is hard to show that screening truly works. On the other hand, my personal opinion is that for us, it's part of a series of things that have worked. So I usually recommend it as simple as it worked for us. And second of all, there is really a culture both at work and at school that, putting it kind of bluntly, you come to work unless you're really sick, unless you're dead, or unless you're hospitalized. And one of the things we want to do is discourage that, because I've had the experience of talking to someone who I said, geez, you're just not that sick. There's no way you have COVID. I had someone who just had a sore throat, and her doctor wanted to test her for COVID. I did not think she had COVID. I just simply thought she was too well, and she had it. And so one of the things we're trying to do is simply discourage people from coming to work or school when they're sick. And my personal opinion is if you have to go tell someone that you haven't had a fever, cough, or a temperature, and you know that in order to get into work, you're going to have to lie to them, you're more likely to stay home. So I personally think screening works. The caller is absolutely right. It doesn't catch everyone. And it's based on experience, not good evidence-based medicine.
My highest temperature has been 97.5. I thought that normal was 98.6. I hear you about the answer. That 98 is, we've kind of gone away from that, haven't we?
Yeah, I mean, most people, mine gets checked every day, and it's always a little lower than 98.6. If it gets up into 99, if I found it was 99 when I checked into work, I'd go back home.
And by the way, let our listeners know that we have about a half hour left in the program, a little less than that. If you have a question for Dr. John Goldman, infectious disease specialist at UPMC Pinnacle, about COVID-19, this is a good opportunity to ask it. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. A couple questions about research, Dr. Goldman. Just yesterday, news that the University of Florida had done some research that found that droplets can travel much further than what we've been told, up to 16 feet. Now, that would seem to defeat our 6 feet apart social distancing guidelines. What do you think about that research, and what should that do to our behavior?
So what that illustrates is that we are learning more and more about the disease. What that likely does to our behavior is I suspect that 6 feet is much better than 1 or 2 feet. I think that 10 feet is probably better than 6 feet. And if we, when we're trying to, what we're really trying to do with this disease is slow down its transmission. And so I would guess that 6 feet slows it down. My guess is 10 or 16 feet slows it down much more. But we have to balance being practical. If you have people 10 feet apart in a room, it's hard. You have fewer people in the room than if you have them 6 feet apart. And so that kind of illustrates why we have to do multiple things. You know, I'll hear occasionally, well, if your mask works, why does other people have to wear masks? You're protecting yourself. Well, it's because if both of you are wearing a mask, the chances of transmission goes down. If both of you are wearing a mask and you are standing 6 feet apart, the transmission goes down further. On a kind of population-based level, if we slow down the transition, the transmission of the virus, the goal is to slow it so that down to the point where less than, for each person infected, they infect less than one additional people, and the virus begins to decrease and even go away. What we really don't want to happen is to, you know, not mask, be close together. So the virus can infect 2.5-3 people if there's no social distancing, if there's no masking. And then we have exponential spread. So then we have it go up really quickly. What we've really successfully done is decrease the rate of transmission so that it's going slowly through the population as opposed to rapidly. And each one of these interventions, masking, social distancing, in the spring closing the schools, is did a part to decrease the infectiousness and decrease the spread of the virus.
One other question about research. The article in the latest edition of Science magazine seems to indicate that, you know, this is some research, some peer-reviewed research, that seems to indicate that those exposed to another coronavirus are less susceptible to serious symptoms from COVID-19. May have something to do with T cells. Without getting too far into the weeds, what do you think of this?
I think it's almost certainly true, but we don't know for what percentage of the population it is true. So and most of us have at some point in our life been exposed to another coronavirus, probably more than one. And there is probably some cross immunity, meaning if you've had an infection with one of the other coronaviruses, you have some quicker immune response to the novel coronavirus. The problem that we have is we don't know how frequent that is or how effective that is. So there's no way that you could know that you've been infected with the right coronavirus to give you a little bit of immunity. And there's no way that you would know, even if you knew that you had been infected with the right coronavirus, there's no way you would know how effective that would be. The way I would phrase this is, I hope so, because that would mean there's some of the population that's already immune. That may be why some people get less sick than others. But we're still at the phase of the pandemic where we don't have a great understanding of the disease. And I suspect in 2, 3, 4, 5 years, we'll have a really good answer to that question. We don't know.
You know, something that, I think you were the one that I learned this from, is that a common cold is a coronavirus. But there's SARS and other coronaviruses out there. And as you said, it's more than likely that some people have been exposed to a coronavirus before, another form. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Our guest is Dr. John Goldman, infectious disease specialist at UPMC Pinnacle. He's answering questions about COVID-19, the coronavirus. If you have a question or comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. We have a phone call from Tom. Tom, you're on the air.
Good morning, Dr. Goldman. I got a question for you.
Certainly.
I've got four friends, all in the same family. Two of them were healthcare workers that brought the virus home. And they all had full-blown symptoms, especially the loss of the sense of smell and taste. And they were each tested three times, and the first two out of three times, they came back negative. By the time they tested positive, their symptoms had subsided, and some of them were going, two of them were going about their business, out shopping and things. In the news media, there's been a tremendous amount of discussion about testing and not enough test kits, et cetera. If the tests are this inaccurate, how valuable do you see the testing? And from your personal experience, not from your anecdotal experience, what percentage of test inaccuracies have you personally observed?
So there is, unfortunately, not a good answer to how sensitive, how accurate the test is, because there's no gold standard. So there's no test that is better than the PCR to tell us how accurate the PCR mm-hmm. is. My personal experience has been I do see cases like what you described where someone is clearly exposed. They, on the second, usually the second test, turned positive after a first test was negative. Or, for example, we've had a husband and wife with similar symptoms, and one was positive, one was negative. My guess, and this is going to be a guess, is that's about 10% of the cases. In sick people, we do a fair amount of retesting. So we often have people who have been in the hospital, and people say the COVID test is negative, but they're so sick that they have to have COVID, and we retest them. Those tests are rarely positive. So what seems to be in the literature and what seems to be good objective medicine is you're more likely to have a positive test as the illness goes on. If you test too early, it may not be positive. And there's some debate about where you get the test from. If it's a good, deep specimen from the nasal pharynx as opposed to early in the nose, and I'll point out that if you really get a good, deep specimen, it's not a pleasant procedure. It hurts. So I believe the test is very accurate. I think it's probably a little less accurate early in the disease. And for example, if I hear that someone lost their sense of taste or smell, that's a pretty characteristic. There aren't a lot of other things besides COVID that can give you that. And so I usually believe that they're infected. But again, this is one of the limits that we have. This is the best test we have. And when it's the best test you have, you don't have another test that tells you how accurate it is. We don't, for example, culture the virus out of people's noses on a regular basis. So I think it's pretty good. I think one of the issues that you talked about is that it takes a while for the test to come back, and that often interferes. People sometimes are better by the time they realize they were infected.
But from your description, if you're screening a general population, if they're early in the disease and asymptomatic, it's not likely to be highly reliable.
And that's, again, very controversial, because if they're asymptomatic, that's clearly where you have the most false negative tests. On the other hand, we do know that people who are asymptomatic can have a positive test for weeks, even after they appear to have cleared the virus. So one of the problems with screening people who have no symptoms is that you both can miss cases and you can overdiagnose them. If you had COVID a month ago, it's possible that your test is still positive, even though you almost certainly have cleared the virus and are no longer infectious.
Hey, Tom, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Goldman, we're getting a lot of questions about tests. This isn't about tests so much as, and you kind of just touched on this, if a person has recovered from COVID-19, do we know whether they can still carry the disease to others?
Yeah, so there are very clear guidelines that are based on data from the CDC that if you had mild COVID, you can be cleared, you're not likely to be infectious after 10 days, provided that you have not had a fever in the last 24 hours and that your symptoms are improving. For severe COVID, someone who is hospitalized, someone that needs oxygen, that should be 20 days. What they have found has been that although the PCR, they can find the virus's genes in the nose for a prolonged period of time, when they actually try to culture the virus, it goes away a lot more quickly. The most recent guidance from both the CDC and the Department of Health is for mild disease, that typically takes 10 days, and for severe disease, 20 days. Again, that's one of the things that we're figuring out.
Steve asks, what do we know about how long COVID antibodies remain in our systems?
Oh, we don't know a lot yet. So there are two issues. One is how long the antibodies remain in the system, and two, how likely you are to either be immune or have less severe disease once you've been exposed, regardless of the antibodies. So it's about 3 months, in that 3 to 6 months in someone who has mild disease, probably about a year to 2 years in someone who has severe disease. People who have more worse disease clearly get a more vigorous antibody response. On the other hand, even having the antibodies go away doesn't necessarily mean that you can get it again. And if you get it again, you're much more likely to have less severe disease. The first time a disease goes through the population and no one has any immune response to it, pre-existing immune response to it, it spreads more quickly and it causes more severe disease. And we have a lot of experience this with pandemic flu. When new flu viruses appear, the first time it appears, it causes a lot of disease and makes people very sick. Each year, as it goes through the population and more people have partial immunity, even if they get the virus again, they become less and less sick. So, for example, the pandemic influenza of 1968, which I think killed about 100,000 Americans, is still the same flu virus that's with us and circulates each winter, but it doesn't cause pandemic flu. It doesn't make a whole lot of people sick and a whole lot of people very sick. It causes typical flu. It causes a typical flu season because we already have some pre-existing immunity to it.
You mentioned the flu, and we've heard a lot more talk about what happens when flu season starts, September, October. There may be people who may not know the difference between their symptoms of having the flu or COVID-19. What are your concerns about the upcoming flu season?
My concerns about the upcoming flu season are exactly that. We have the potential to have both COVID and the flu, which will clearly tax our medical system. And it will drive up the need for testing further because we'll have to, you really can't tell clinically whether or not it is influenza or COVID. They can present exactly in the same way, with the exception of you probably aren't going to lose your sense of taste or smell with the flu. So it is going to result in more people going to ERs, showing up at their family doctors, and it's going to result in the need for more testing. The good news is, in the southern hemisphere, where it's currently flu season, remember it's their winter right now, because people are masking, because people are practicing social distancing, they're fortunately having a mild flu season. I hope to see the same thing here.
You know, I was thinking the same thing, is that many of the mitigating things we've done to mitigate this disease could help to slow down the spread of the flu. Washing hands, the masking, all the things. So maybe it will. We have another question here from a listener. Mike is on the phone. Mike is in Annville. Mike, you're on the air.
Good morning. Doctor, I have a question for you. I was okay with the COVID. 71-year-old male lives alone. And then about a month ago, and I watched the news a lot, I cut back on that, but I lost my appetite to eat. And my doctor sent me to the medical center. They did a workup, and everything came back normal. But I'm sleeping a lot more. I feel like hopelessness. I forced myself to eat. I lost 15 pounds in about a month. I only weigh like 130-some pounds. I have a friend that's a therapist. I talked to him, and he said I should see a psychiatrist. I know it's hard to make a diagnosis of what I told you, but...
Very hard to diagnose people over the phone.
Yeah.
but anytime I see someone with a 15-pound weight loss, they need to be checked out.
My doctor.
Because
well,
no one loses weight accidentally in central Pennsylvania. There's too much good food around. So my advice would be...
No appetite for food.
My advice would be you need to see your doctor. If you have feelings of hopelessness and weight loss, it almost certainly would be good to see a psychiatrist and also talk to your doctor about possible, before you see a psychiatrist, treatment for possible depression. But obviously, I can't diagnose you over the phone. You should see your doctor.
Right. Well, you know, Dr. Goldman, the point he raises, are there going to be long-term, maybe even permanent, mental scars as a result of this COVID-19?
There already have been. So one of the things that has clearly occurred is people, because of the lockdown, because of social distancing, have become more socially isolated. That is not good for people's mental health. So we are seeing more depression, more anxiety, more substance abuse because of this. Also, people who have COVID can very frequently get post-viral fatigue. You know, if you get the flu, it's not uncommon to be very tired afterwards. And if you get COVID, it is very common to take weeks to get back to how you were, especially with things like energy, because it's probably like your body getting hit by a truck. And it takes a while for the body to recover, especially if you're older, especially if you're 71. But it is both because of the lockdown, because of social isolation, more depression, anxiety, and people who have COVID also get very tired, which can mimic depression and anxiety.
Mike from Camp Hill says, how long do you wait until you should get tested after being exposed?
So I would suggest that, well, for being exposed, you should be tested if you have symptoms. So the problem with the testing is they tell you at that moment you aren't infected. And what we've had happen is we have people from high-risk populations, nursing homes, who we now, as soon as they come in the hospital, we put them on precautions for at least 2 weeks. Because we've had people from nursing homes, and we test people from nursing homes for asymptomatic COVID infection. And we've had them test negative and then turn positive. The issue, if you are exposed, the protocol is to have isolation for 2 weeks because that's the incubation period of the virus. People are beginning to study if you are negative, how long, what are the chances that if you get test negative, what are the chances you can become positive? But for the most part, all the test does is tells you that you aren't infected today. It doesn't tell you that you won't be infected tomorrow.
Dr. John Goldman, we're running out of time, but as always, want to thank you very much for being on the program today. You know, I said at the beginning of the show, it still surprises me the number of questions that people have, but we are learning so much about this illness, about this virus as we go. Dr. Goldman, I'm sure we'll be talking to you again. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up on Monday, we have a number of different topics, but we're going to be talking about congressional redistricting as one of them.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.